So the satsang tonight is an effort to break through the conditions that have formatted the collective ego at the end of Kali Yuga. It was there all through, but in the beginning, Kali Yuga had the egos were in a more sattvic state, and then more rajasic, and then finally they're in the tamasic, and the lowest vibration of tamas, the tamopradhan vibration. And most egos that are not on a spiritual path are attuned to that level of the collective consciousness, and the vibrational frequency turns them into hungry ghosts. And a hungry ghost can never be satisfied. And a hungry ghost feels empty and unreal. Its very existence is in question, and it's filled with self-doubt and doubt of everything, which may be covered over by a false certainty, but the doubt eats away at the ability of the ego in that state to be able to rationally work itself free of this collective paradigm and shift out of it into one's real self. Now, it's very interesting. If you go back to the history of yoga in the time of the transition from Dwapar to Kali Yuga, when the Saraswati River basin was still functioning and flowing, and the so-called Harappan or Mohenjo-Daro civilization was alive and well, the practice of yoga was already present and was passed on from guru to disciple, with only oral teachings that were not written down for really. In the case of the original yogis, thousands of years, actually. Because it wasn't until about 800 CE that some of those original concepts of what became known as Pashupata Yoga became inscribed as smriti, as texts that were canonical for these yogis who had realized that the true nature of our being transcends subjectivity. And so the evolution of the Pashupata yogis was that after a certain amount of time and fall of the Indian general culture, which was still relatively holy, but there were no longer any avatars present. There were very few realized yogis. There were some, but very few. And they were living separately from the caste system. And so the Brahmins became pundits. Then they repeated and did the rituals of the Vedas, etc. But they lost the true meaning of liberation. And so the Pashupatas re-entered the social sphere, but they did it in a totally antinomian way. they became the Agoris. How many of you have heard of the Agoris? Yeah? Okay, it means the terrible ones. And the Agoris they broke every rule, and they had no interest in any of the concepts of the Vedic tradition or the social order whatsoever. They tended to hang out in cremation grounds. They were naked other than the dust that they put on their bodies from the funeral pyres. And they remained in a state of absolute samadhi, but they did take, they did accept disciples, the ones who were realized. And this tradition and the Pashupata tradition as a whole, the Agoris being one thread of that larger tradition. Not all of them were Agoris, but this tradition remains alive today. There are still Agoris in India, and they are still acting, at least in the way that they traditionally did. And there's a famous story of most of them are considered to be very low class, uneducated, and complete trash by the main, socially adapted people who don't really appreciate their attainment. But those who are aware of the vibrational frequency that they have emanated throughout history to sustain the culture, from a place of wanting nothing from it and of being completely indifferent to its values. There was a recent Agori who became one in midlife. He had a midlife crisis, apparently. And before that, he was a professor of physics at a major Indian university, and very famous as a physicist. And then he gave it all up, and threw off his clothes and went into one of these cremation grounds and became a disciple of one of the Agoris who was the real thing, and then graduated to become probably the most well-known teacher of the modern period. And most people who would meet him in the cremation ground didn't know his background, and assumed that he was uneducated. He was one time visited by a physicist who was looking down on him and said, "Why are you wasting your life in this way and all that?" And he said, "Well, I'll tell you what, if you can figure out a certain physics problem that it took me years to figure out, then I'll consider, going back." And he gave him this problem, and the guy couldn't figure it out. It was way beyond him. He was in shock and awe of the intelligence of this being, and he bowed to him. And I don't know whether he became an Agori himself, but he certainly became a devotee. And so these beings who make such a radical decision are acting in a way that's extremely rare, but they have recognized that if you want liberation, you have to pay a price. And part of the price, very interesting, when you graduate from being a disciple to being named as an acharya, or a guru, a spiritual teacher in the Agori tradition, you have to go through a final initiation in which you have to make yourself as disgusting as possible. You have to make yourself smell really bad so that no one wants to come near you. You have to arrange for your reputation to have been ruined so that everyone thinks, you know, you're a charlatan and a fake and you're in it for the money or to sexually abuse women devotees. You have to create that kind of a bad image of yourself and create such a reputation where no one's going to bother you except those who can see through that facade. And so this Aghori, you know, did that. But the idea is this, that the final attachment that the consciousness has to the ego is based on a feeling of shame, disgust, and of course envy and greed and anger, but it's shame and disgust that are the most difficult to remove, right? So they would, you know, smear feces on their bodies when they gave a satsang and, you know, acted in ways that were so horrifying that it would create a shock to those who recognized the power of their presence but were nonplussed by their appearance. And the teachings of this school was that until you had been okay with being as hated and as seemingly toxic and completely unconscionably unworthy of union with God, only in that state would you be able to completely let go of any attachment to the character, to the ego. You would have to be completely free of any care about how anyone else saw you or perceived your status, your spiritual stature. And these yogis were so clear about this that they enacted it spontaneously in all of their behavior. So if you wanted to apply to become a devotee of one of these Aghori gurus, you would have to sit with him and drink a cup of tea that would be, you know, made in the cremation ground. And it would be the same teacup that he used day in and day out. They weren't into washing their cups. They weren't into, you know, washing or cleanliness of any kind, obviously. So they wouldn't react to the COVID fear very much at all, I have no doubt. And their ability to simply not care, because it wasn't fake, it was real. They did not care about the fate of the body. And more than that, they would usually put some sugar in the tea, and the sugar would attract flies, and the flies would fall into the tea and die. And so this devotee who was telling the story said, you know, he looked at the tea with all of these dead flies in it, and he couldn't drink it. He still had a bit of disgust and felt like, oh no, this is too much. I can't handle it. I know I'm going to be rejected as a disciple now. I'll never be able to study and learn from this guru. And some minutes went by, and the guru said to him, "You haven't drunk your tea." And he said, "You know, there's dead flies in it." And the guru said, okay. And he took the flies out and he ate them. And then he handed the cup to him. He said, "No, no more dead flies." And the devotee still couldn't quite swallow it. He decided he wasn't quite ready for that path. But he was so impacted by that event and that interaction that he had a transformative experience of letting go of most of his sanskaras. He didn't quite get to that final level, but he did make a huge progress and continued studying, but not as an Aghori, but in another lineage of the Pashupatas. But why am I bringing all of this up? We are not Pashupatas, and so I'm not presenting this as a teaching or a suggestion that anyone act in the same way, all right? And that form of yoga actually evolved into the Kashmir Shaivite tantric, non-dual tantric tradition that came shortly after, in which Abhinavagupta and Somananda and the other gurus of those wisdom schools decided that to move forward, they would have to shift the sense of disgust and of complete indifference to the bodily and the mental state and the social status into the symbolic realm and not act it out in real one. And so they turned this into a process of inner work, in which there was a very deep self-analysis regarding one's attachment to the ego. Now, the relevance of all of this is that in the final lifetime at the end of Kali Yuga, many egos are toxic, disgusting, have no self-worth to themselves. I'm talking about a subjective self-image and attitude that's identical with the one that the Pashupatas deliberately created and invoked and acted out. And if there could be a recognition that this is actually the highest blessing, to have an ego that you don't actually want to hold on to, and that has no value, and all it is an obstacle to liberation, because that false identity of the character has no validity in terms of the real, the supreme real, in which there is only God, and only the purity and goodness and beauty and absolute infinite glory of the Supreme Presence. And so if one could recognize that gift of having an ego that is not really wanted, it doesn't serve you, it creates only misery, it creates only suffering, it only can hold you back. And the only way out of the trap is freedom from those kinds of dualities. But as we evolve at the end of Kali Yuga, I would say that our approach must shift from Pashupata to Rajapata. Now, I have to explain a little bit the meaning of the Pashupata. Pata means lord, and Pashu can be one of two or both, defined in two different ways. One is a beast, an animal, but it's because the body is an animal body. It doesn't mean beast in the biological sense. In the same way that the French, when they use the word bête, they don't mean a beast; they mean somebody who is stupid, basically. Ignorant and unable to recognize the truth of their real self. So, Pashu means Secondly, one who is fettered. Fettered meaning you have bonds. Because in the ancient world, the Pashupatas originally were mostly cowherders and nomads before they settled down, and when they were still in the Saraswati River basin and hadn't moved into the Ganga area. And there, at night, they would have to put hobbles on the cows and their horses to keep them from running away into strange territory. So the idea is that God is the Lord of those who are still in bondage, still in fetters. And the primary fetter is this attachment to the self-esteem of the ego. And suffering over a lack thereof. So this is the achievement to be accomplished from the position of the unreal in order to get to the real. But our approach is the opposite. It's to recognize immediately that you are nothing other than the pristine beauty of the Absolute Self and its infinite creative intelligence that was never born and has no karma. And by realizing that, the ego sanskaras, which include perhaps being disgusting and unworthy and feeling like one is hopelessly separated from God, etc., all the delusions of the ego, are annihilated instantly when the love that unites the consciousness with the Absolute Self is total. And no attachment to the ego identity remains. And so you don't need to sit in cremation grounds and act in such ways in which your life becomes, in a certain sense, fettered by its inability to participate in the social order in a way that might have more effect. But effect is not something that a Pashupata has any concern with, because it's all in the hands of God, and there's no ego left to want anything, including the betterment of the world or any of that. But from the Rajapata, which means the Lord of Kings, of those with the divine rights of kings and queens and have divine royalty, from that perspective, we are indeed transforming the world into a kingdom of heaven through the shift of the vibrational frequency of the morphogenic field. And so there's a different point of attack, you could say, in the approach to liberation between the Pashupata yogis and Sat yogis. But the same principle is valid for both. That principle that only by completely annihilating attachment to the individual subject that identifies with the body and with the thinking apparatus, only by completely cutting that, but through love and through recognition and through knowledge and wisdom, and ultimately ecstatic love, this is cut without any external actions being necessary, without leaving the society, without acting as a fearsome yogi who is unable to fit into the social order. So the indifference has to go so deep that there is no longer a narrative of indifference and of separation from the subjectivity. there cannot be any narrative whatsoever left. The mind has to be in total stillness. The apparatus can obviously function when necessary and teach, but there is no attachment to whatever action the vehicles perform, because the entire attention is focused on the light, the power of presence, the bliss, and the intuitive knowing of the real self, and the recognition that the world is an appearance within one's consciousness, not outside of it. There is no other, no duality, and therefore no conflict, and no judgments of anyone or anything, no judgments, but a recognition. And this is where the paradox of the Pashupata guru lies. There's no judgments, but if you won't drink those flies, you don't qualify to be a Pashupata or a Nagori. So there are proofs of one's willingness to live out the ultimate implications of what one has recognized, even though that living out now would come more in a sense of being free of the fear of death, or in the same way free of the fear of losing one's reputation, etc. Perhaps this one has gone through his initiation, having a website devoted to slandering him, etc. So I don't know if that's sufficient, but certainly it was God's will for there to be total indifference to that as well. And one has to be able to carry through the power of the Tao that is moving the body mind into action as purely the will of God, without any interference by an ego mind that wonders, should I really do that or shouldn't I, or has any kind of reaction to the spontaneous action of the presence of God as the moving power that is the only real agency of consciousness. So this is the breakthrough that is required in order to reach freedom. In some way, I'm talking about the retreat that's about to happen, called The Great Escape, because we are dealing with paths to liberation. And this was one of the great historic yogic paths, which can no longer be followed in its original way, but from which we can take the wisdom that enables us to make it completely relevant and decisive for our conviction and our recognition that this cutting of the last concern for how one appears in the world as the final rite of passage into freedom. And it's not just how one appears in the world, but how one appears in one's own mind. There cannot be a superego attacking. There cannot be any thoughts. All of that has to be annihilated, not merely put on pause, but completely eliminated once and for all. And only then is there graduation from this this great game, this video game in which we now are in the midst of the great escape. Interestingly, in the film, The Great Escape, which I haven't seen entirely. I looked at a few scenes. It seems like the artwork we used with someone who doesn't look like Steve McQueen on the motorcycle is not the one who escaped. What they did was create four tunnels to get out of the prison camp. And that actually serves the teachings of this coming retreat, because there are actually four pathways, and they are underground pathways in the sense that they're secret. No one else will know about them, or that you're in the tunnel. They are the deepest internal transformational pathways, and there are four of them that you can choose from to escape the prison camp. But you do have to do the quantum tunneling, or qualium tunneling, even more importantly, to get out of the paradigm of the ego that is the prison. And it requires the same kind of totality of recognition of what is real and what is unreal, and the decision to surrender totally to the real. And so we are given a final period in order to break through those last fetters, those last chains of attachment to the ego that are present both as internal mental objects and external objects of desire, of fear, of negative judgment, any objectification and any subjectification creates a bondage. And it's only when the mind is in stillness that the escape can be completed. So that's the teaching, and that's the purpose of the retreat. And because of the urgency of the time, as we approach the end of time, I think this retreat, for anyone who is courageous enough to face the need for indifference from the character and complete adoration and oneness with the Absolute Self, will be able to achieve instantaneous liberation. But it does require that shift of the heart from the ego to the soul, and the soul in its most sattvic state of love of God and of union, that brings about the final liberation, in which there is only God. There is no world. There never was a world. All of it is your own imagination. And once you're beyond that level of the imagination, you become the dreamer, no longer trapped in any dream, but with the power to redream and to bring the divine cities of infinite wisdom, joy, beauty, love, purity, goodness into a world that becomes a visual and a complete sensory paradise and a super sensory celestial realm of nirvanic bliss that is superimposed and in oneness with the dance of life that is lived out in all of the glory of divine empowerment for thousands of years in the next cycle that we are now co-creating. So may we achieve that freedom from the fetters of our own individual ego mind. and realize the truth as the self. Okay, let's see. Where are we in time and space? I think I will open the floor here. I was going to read some passages of Ramana relating to this topic, but somehow this is what Shiva wanted to be spoken. So I hope this was helpful and not confusing to anyone. And please don't leave here and try to find a cremation ground, but do burn the ego as soon as possible. Namaste. So Meg is there if anyone wants to ask anything or contribute any comments.
Thank you, Shunya, for tonight and for this retreat. I'm not really sure how to put this into a question. It feels very complicated in my mind. It's probably very simple, really. I'm dealing with, in this moment, I'm dealing with a lot of anxiety, but I feel like I'm going through the finally going through the Oedipus complex, let's put it that way. And trying to install a kind of internal father. And I have it's a few parts to this question. The first part is, what happens to the psyche when there is no barrier to the sight of the mother's body, right? That it, there's no competition, there's no one to say no, and that desire, which kind of clicks into the shame and the disgust that you were speaking about, having to come to terms with the shame and the disgust that I feel for the desire that I had. So maybe that's just the...
Well, the desire is not what you have, it's what your character has, okay? You don't have to install the name of the father or go through an Oedipus complex. That's a myth. It doesn't even really exist. That was Freud's mythology that people bought into. The real self is who you are. You could not be anything else. It's not a matter of installing it as if it's some fabrication or belief in an ideal or in a sense of separation from the mother and the need to go on a quest in solitude and in rejection of desire. No, desire comes from lack, but that lack is lack of the realization of the self. That's the problem, okay? The father in the more traditional family represented the self, which is the supreme father. But now there are very few representatives of the self. However, the self is here and is within and is your own consciousness and cannot be anything else. So what you need to do is focus on yourself as consciousness that is aware of the character and its narrative and its pornographic images or desires of chakra 2 and of egoic possession, etc., etc. And once you have realized who you are and that this appearance in the phenomenal hologram has no ability to fetter you. It can't cause you to identify with that narrative. Your power of freedom from what causes you suffering and what you have learned is a dead end, a jouissance that always ends up in a shame or in another state of of feeling like a failure. This is the character's endless loop, and it has to be put to rest completely and dissolved so that you return to your true essence, which is just pure presence without thought. And if you stay in that state long enough, you will not only be in stillness of mind, but the heart will open in bliss and in a level of intelligence that changes your entire attitude toward life and toward reality, and focuses entirely on the liberation, not of the individual subjectivity, because that's no longer who you are, but with the upliftment of the collective consciousness to return to oneness with God. And that will give such joy and such fulfillment that the lower desires of the ego will simply disappear, because the power of this bliss is greater than any joy or momentary happiness that the sexual desire can bring you. And once you have tasted that, the consciousness will not return. But it's very important to not identify with that narrative and think it's your narrative. It's not. It's simply a set of handcuffs that you, with your Houdini drive, is now able to get out of and gain the victory of God consciousness. So this is the moment of Jaya Dev. It's not Oedipus, it's God, okay? Go for the highest level of liberation and empowerment. And once you have realized that, this will all be not only history, but will have turned into wisdom that will enable you to be a great healer and uplifter of infinite number of souls.
Thank you. This sort of maybe pales into insignificance after that answer. But I wonder, I think there's still some, okay, there's a technical difficulty in that. I feel like there's a self-image that got stuck at around 12 years old, and that holds for me everything that I hate, let's say, about myself, right? Mm-hmm. And I've pushed out, and I've mm-hmm. refused to look at. Now he's coming back.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like I have to sort of welcome him in a way. And
why?
Well, because pushing him away is just...
No, neither one. It's a delusion. You don't have to push away a delusion, but you also don't have to welcome it and buy into it as if it's real. It's not. Okay? If you wake up from a nightmare, you don't say, oh, I better have that nightmare again and, you know, converse with those demons that I saw in the nightmare and make them feel welcome, you know, during the day. Uh-uh, you don't need to do that. That's a false idea that the superego is giving you, because it wants to keep you in chains. No need for any of that.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for this teaching. I feel just jolted and thrilled by it. And I think it has to do with, well, many of the things that you spoke of. The one was just indeed the disgust and the shame. I've been going through a lot of that today, and even just before this class, having a moment of being in tears and feeling there was this strong sense of like, I'm evil, or I did evil things, or people saw me as evil, and just feeling terrible about that.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a very strange state to be in. It was like I could feel Satan inside me, mm-hmm. and also that there's something inside me that's just been enjoying all of the evil from this life or perhaps past lives as well. And it was a very disgusting, strange, painful state to be in. But hopefully good, at least to see that part of myself or to see that there's something like that going on. And then when you mentioned just the indifference, this was shocking because I noticed how much of a sanskara there is to not being mm-hmm. indifferent. Mm-hmm. There's an immense care about what people think about me and how people see me. And mm-hmm. And so just you talking about that, like I could feel while you were speaking this fetter being mm-hmm. shaken open mm-hmm. and this desire to say, no more of that. I'm like, mm-hmm. let it go. Mm-hmm. It's not necessary. Mm-hmm. And so that's just come with a thrill and an excitement. And I wanted to share that in any case.
No, you've achieved the ideal Aghori ego image. So, you know, congratulations, you know, and be proud of it in a way, right? Uh-huh. But it's a pride that enables you to fully realize you're not that character. But that character had to come to seem to exist in order for you to free yourself from any identification with what you thought is good about the character, mm. right? Mm-hmm. So both of them have to be let go of,
yeah.
right? What you like or the jouissance it gives you or whatever, right, which balances the shame and this horror. Both of them are illusions. And by transcending both polarities of the egos, good and evil, and by the way, it's not Satan. It's your imaginary idea that Satan lives in you. That's a kind of megalomania, you know. Satan doesn't bother to come, you know, in your body. Satan is also transcendent and is merely an archetype that is activated at the end of time in order for there to be a final meeting of the dark and the light. And this actually becomes the annihilation of the matter and antimatter cosmos as a biverse. And this comes about as a result of total acceptance, which annihilates the polarization. And at the same time, there is a depolarization between Shiva and Shakti, between the world as energy and form and beauty or ugliness or however the world appears and the essence of the intelligence that collapses the quantum and qualium waves in such a way that it appears that way to you. But there is no universe other than your own mind that is collapsing the field through your interpretation of yourself as being one of the satanic majesties, you know, to use a Rolling Stone term that they were proud of back then in the 60s. So you have to accept that this is the will of God, that this was the ego appearance you were given as a beautiful example of how the victory of God over the delusion can occur no matter how bad the illusion looks, mm-hmm. right? That because darkness is not real. Only the light is real. Mm. And it's your belief that creates the shadow, that creates the satanic feelings and the shame and the guilt and all of that. None of it has any reality whatsoever. And when you're no longer attached to your ego and don't care if it's good or bad, because there's no such thing as good or bad. Mm. All is God. That duality was, right, eating the tree in the Garden of Eden that made us lose paradise. We don't fall into judgment or dualistic thinking or subject-object separation. And when we are free of that, all we see is light, love, beauty, joy, freedom, infinite creative intelligence. That's all there is. There is nothing else out there, though, because now the screen is wiped clean of all sanskaras, and the great artist of God consciousness can now produce a new world that's free of any trace of the Kali Yuga stains. Mm. And that's the function of a Sat Yogi at the end, right? Clean the whiteboard completely and then project your divine nature as beauty and goodness and purity and joy and love, and let that be seen as the model that vibrates in such a way that others will be uplifted and brought to a state of awakening through the shining of your consciousness through the world. Mm.
Thank you. That's a lot to chew on. But it's nicer to chew on that.
Just swallow it. Don't chew it.
Oh, gee.
Okay. And remember, you are that now. It doesn't require any effort. Mm. It's simply a shift of the location of your consciousness from the Kronos circle to the ion at the center, right? Mm. And then once you're there, every moment is a Kairos moment in which the perfection of God is able to descend into the Kronos world, and your body becomes an avatar of that vibrational frequency and that intelligence. But there's no more ego to take credit for it, just as you wouldn't take blame for the ego's shameful attitudes and, mm-hmm. and attributes, but just an unchanging, blissful realization of the real.
Mm-hmm. Aji, I'm going to take that with me. No good and no bad. There's a lot of that going on. That was good and that was bad. And that was
right.
good and that was bad.
Yeah, you're not allowed to have that polarity. Okay.
Thank you for this teaching. I found it very, it fit what I've been feeling these last couple of weeks. I feel like you started the rainy season retreat with this invitation of going on a honeymoon with yourself and this love for yourself. And it's always with these invitations, I feel like there's the most confrontation with these feelings that you described tonight. And I don't know, I think what's come mostly out of tonight is feeling or seeing like it's not this personal issue. Like it's part of a structure that's this of a game to mm-hmm. to accomplish, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think kind of trying to take it in this way is helpful. And I like the stories you told about the Agoras, and I'm curious about this cup of tea, and I feel like it almost sounds like, and I'm wondering about what is its relation to the story of Shiva and drinking the having a blue throat and drinking the poison but not, or swallowing the poison, like you said to Karuna, you have to swallow it, right? But he doesn't swallow it.
Shiva doesn't swallow it.
He turns it back into wisdom, mm-hmm. and is that sort of the idea of the tea, or
It's a little different because the story of Shiva is at a higher assemblage point where what is being rejected, the poison that's being taken so no one else is hurt by it, but then is transformed through the digestive juices in the mouth only. The salivary glands juices, which are enough for Shiva to detoxify the poison, and then it can emerge as a nectar. This is the full realization of yourself as the manifestation of God on earth, and nothing short of that. And you see, in the mythology of Parvati, the goddess consort of Shiva, there are many stories in the Puranas about Parvati and Shiva. But when she realizes that she has not yet been fully divinized and hasn't activated her divine potential yet, she performs tapas. She goes into a period of solitude and silence and internal stillness to eliminate the sanskaras that remain of an ego that believes it exists as a person, even though it believes it's a divine person, but it still believes it's a person as an individual subjectivity, not as the heart of Shiva. It's itself, herself, himself. It's not that level of love. So what Parvati has to do, first of all, she goes inward until she finds the inner light. And she feels filled with the light of God shining within her. And then she realizes, well, wait a minute, the light emanates from God, but the light can't be God. God has that light, but God must be beyond the light. And so she lets go of her interest in that supernal light. She loses all interest in that entirely. And then she realizes the emptiness, the shunyata, and she recognizes that this too is a manifestation of God as unmanifest, as the womb of the world in a certain way. But she realizes this too is a projection of Shiva that is responsible for creating new worlds, new cycles of time within that stillness of the field of consciousness that is Brahman, right? And then she goes into the inconceivable, in which there is no Parvati left, and there is only an indescribable, inconceivable presence that is the presence of Paramashiva, but there's no one there to know it or say, I made it, or I got there. All of that is gone, and the consciousness is entirely absorbed into its own original absolute nature. That's the inner work that you must now complete.
Thank you.
Okay, since you were speaking of the mountain goddess, today I was thinking about vasanas and vrittis, this idea that there's the riverbed and then there's these eddies, I think you call them, like the swirls that represent the thoughts. And I was wondering...
The riverbed is the sanskaras, the river is the vasanas. And then the little eddies are the vrittis.
Okay, so that was my question. How do the vasanas fit into that? Because there's a tendency to create rivers. But interestingly, I started to think back. Well, you know, what has a tendency to create the riverbed? And I ended up at an image of Mount Kailash actually. Mm. And in what I was reading, there's actually four rivers that that. Start mm-hmm. from there. You're speaking about these four yes. underground tunnels that are escapes.
Yes.
But what caught me from tonight's teaching was this idea that civilizations actually started much closer, much further up the mountain, and then over time the civilizations move further out towards the ocean as well. Is that mm-hmm. does that reflect mm-hmm. the change in consciousness as
oh,
well?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And the Muslims also have four rivers in paradise, right? Uh-huh. Al-Kawthar is one of them, but there's four of them.
I guess my main question is, though, as I was looking at this image of Mount Kailash that was speaking about it as being the Axis Mundi. How does Axis Mundi fit in? How would you describe that in a yogic kind of context?
Your consciousness becomes a pillar of light, and you are contained in and by that pillar, but the light emanates from you. So you are not the light, but you are the source of it. And that light is the pillar that sustains the world. So long as it is straight and strong and powerful, then that pillar enables the world to continue in existence. And when the social order has cut down all of those last pillars of yogis who are fulfilling that function, then the world must end. It collapses on itself. So we are in that moment, however, when the pillars are returning in order to be able to produce the structure that will enable all souls to return to God, and from the singularity, a new beautiful world filled with that power of goodness and of responsible, divine maturity to be able to inhabit it and manage it, be stewards of the creation. And this is the original divine right of kings and queens.
And in a way, I mean, we're in the mountains as well, not to look at it in too phenomenal a way, but does that emanate from here as a geographic location? Because you also talk about the complete collapse and redreaming of the quantum wave as well. Mm-hmm. So it's really not got anything to do with the mountain per se.
Well, it does and it doesn't, you know, just in the same way that when Ramana went to Tiruvannamalai, his vibrational frequency attracted many others who wanted to reach liberation. And he was attracted there because of the saints and sages who had lived there before, who had created that vibrational frequency, so that it was very easy there to feel that pillar of light, that is Shiva, and Shiva appearing as the mountain to be taken in as one's real self-reflection, and then to be in that power of immovability that would never shake, never be disturbed, never be in fear, and be able to pass that serenity into the whole region. And so that was the purpose of it. So in the same way, we have been drawn by the will of God to this mountain to perform a similar function here and now at the end of Kali Yuga. And it will have that quality, at least for a time. But it may be that that's the reason why this mountain earlier, hundreds of years earlier, was a sacred ground of the native Indians who lived here, and whose spirits actually are still around and about and will visit us on some occasions.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, a question from Ute. I process thoughts, which I then do not share in my Atmanology sessions. But I have been wondering whether this is actually making me believe that I am correct with my interpretation of the thought processes, and at the same time, by not sharing it in my sessions, being the one who is one step ahead of the one I work with, because I only talk about everything else that I am dealing with, which gives a totally different picture of where I am and keeps me repeating what is occurring in my life.
Yeah, actually, I think probably 99% of people in Atmanology do the same thing because there's too much shame and guilt to speak about the real thing. Too much, it's too raw, it's too real, too overwhelming, too unbearable. So often these things get forgotten during the session, and then afterwards, oh, yeah, I should have talked about this or that. But there's always this game that the sensor is playing with the conscious mind. So yes, indeed, it's important to be aware of that. But the only reason to spew out these acts or feeling states and attitudes and self-definitions of the ego is to recognize them all as delusional. And ultimately, it's the I thought itself that you want to let go of and achieve a recognition that you were never born, you do not exist, and all you are is that pure presence that is inherently the state of unconditional love. And then when that comes out in the session, it will wipe away all of the other narratives and enable one to stabilize in that state. And the pillar of light and the presence of God consciousness as one's true self will become manifest in one's heart. And the whole character that you are now identified with and trying to straighten out and purify, all of that happens spontaneously without any effort because it was never real. Okay, I hope that's of help. All right, so unless there's a burning question this evening, we will adjourn. How many found this teaching useful? Yeah? Okay, well, that's good. What is important, I think, to take from it is that this is the time to cremate the ego and all of its complexes and all of its narratives and attitudes, and be in that state of such purity of presence that there is no one there, and yet the one is there, the one who is all-containing, all-pervading, all-loving, and is completely beyond space and time, and yet in a constant love union with all that arises in space and time as a manifestation of the beauty and genius of the Supreme Intelligence and the Supreme Love. So this is our destiny if we are willing to let go of the ego's identity markers and its master signifiers and its whole constantly running soundtrack, and to stay in that stillness in which only God is real and only God is here. And you are that. May this realization be given and received as the grace of the all-loving God who wants you to have nothing other than the highest destiny. So, liberation is yours for the asking, for the taking, even without asking, but knowing that this is who you are and you have a right to live in this absolute joy. Namaste.
Namaste.
Thank you.